Okay. All right, well, thanks for having me. I guess you didn't have a choice. About a month and a half ago, Grant asked if I had been taught anything or been learning anything that might be applicable to share in a church setting, and I said yes, but I have a caveat, and that is he asked if I had been learning anything, and I had been, but this may not apply to all of you. This is what I was learning. So I haven't made it, it's not broadly applicable. So you'll have to take what you can from it. And my apologies if you sit there and think this was pointless for me. My message today is kind of leapfrogging off of Matthew 25, the parable of the managers or the stewards who are given the talents to manage. And I'm kind of using that as a starting point, I guess, or a base for the message, because it is what kind of spoke to me, especially around that third manager. So you probably all know the parable. It's pretty well known. It's actually made its way into the field of economics. It's called the Matthew effect of accumulated advantage. And the simple term for it is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And it's the idea that goods and resources attract themselves to those who already have them. And it's a well-studied economic effect. And it fundamentally, it spreads out across societies with as much wealth disparity as we have in our capitalist society. We're actually the least disparate of all, like, human civilizations that have ever existed. It's just persistent, and it's a rough effect. And, you know, I actually think that I had kind of viewed this parable almost to that lens, you know, of like, well, these managers who were good got more, and this poor manager who wasn't very good, you know, got nothing. He got thrown out. And I had a bit of an insight, I guess. I think that maybe changed my perspective about this passage a little bit. Made it be less maybe about the field of economics and more about the field of my life. So we're kind of going to go into that. The parable starts with Jesus tells this parable of this master who goes away on a long journey, and he calls his three managers to him and gives them stewardship over resources. The first manager, he knows this guy's pretty good. He says, here, take 5 talents and manage that for me while I'm gone. And the second manager, or I'm sorry, I'm switching to the Luke version here. The Matthew version, he says, here, take 10 talents and manage them while I'm gone. And then the second manager comes up, and he's pretty good, but the manager doesn't know quite what he's capable of, so he just gives him 5 talents. So he says, yeah, you take care of these 5 for me. And the third one comes up, and, you know, I guess maybe this master had his real doubts about this guy, but he figured he'd give him a shot, and he says, you take 1 talent and manage that for me. I'm going on a trip. See you guys later. And he's out of there. Now, the word talent, you probably all know this, but it was a unit of money. It wasn't a specific, like, coin. It was way too much to be a coin. It was worth about 6,000 drachmas. A drachma was a common, like, pay for a day's labor, for kind of a common laborer. So to put that in perspective, that's about $1 million in our amount of money. If you say $25 an hour for 20 years of work, which is kind of what they figured it was worth, it works out to being about $1 million in today's equivalent. Maybe that's probably the last couple of years have pushed it up to $1 million. A few years ago, it might have been 800,000 or something, but we're up there now. So, you know, it's not a large amount of, or it's not a small amount of money. It's pretty large, but it's actually not a hyperbolic amount of money. And I think that is maybe important in the passage because, one of the other parables that you probably all think of is the parable of the unforgiving servant who went to his master. His master wanted to settle debts, and he said, you owe me 10,000 talents. And that, you know, that's about $10 billion using the same exchange. And if you think about one guy borrowing $10 billion and then just spending it, like, it's hyperbolic, you know, it's beyond reason. But this isn't an unreasonable amount of money. It's actually a reasonable amount of money to give a money manager. The word talent, actually, our word for talent means, like, natural skills and abilities and things we're good at. And It actually, I looked up the etymology of the word, I was curious, and it actually does come from the Greek word talenton, which is the use of the money. And the reason we use it the way we use it today is because of this parable and the way we interpret the parable to be not just about money, but about, like, our skills and abilities, which I think is the right interpretation, but it's interesting. It's actually, like, changed our language and the words we use. So the way we use the English word talent has been changed from money to gifts and abilities through this parable, and etymologists can trace that through time and writings over the last 2,000 years. But I kind of started thinking about it, like, in terms of of 20 years of work, and what struck me about that is, like, that's kind of roughly the time it takes for me to raise my kids, and my family is, like, a 20-year commitment. And so I was kind of like, oh, well, I've got 3 talents in my kids' lives given to me, you know. I've got a talent in my wife. You know, these are 20 years of a human life that have been entrusted to my care, management, supervision. And so that was kind of like a bit of a change in my perspective on the passage that came out, you know, when Grant was speaking about it a couple months ago. So I'm going to start going through the passage. The manager comes back, and he calls his servants together. The first guy comes, and he says, hey, you gave me 10 talents. I have made 10 more. And the master says, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in little. You will be faithful in much. Enter into the joy of your master. And that's good. The servant goes away. The second one comes up, and the master says, hey, how did it go with you? And he said, oh, hey, I got 5 more as well. The master is thrilled with him. Finally, he calls, says the same thing. Finally, he calls the third servant up, and I'll read it from here, verse 24 to 30. So he calls him this third servant, and he says, he also, who had received the 1 talent, came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, have what is yours. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown, and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him, and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast that worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the one thing that struck me out of this passage that I hadn't picked up on before, and I think is really important for what God spoke to me about, is in that phrase that the master says to the third manager. So the man says, here, have what is yours. He gives him his money back. Dirt's on the lid where it's buried. You know, he just pans him this big pile of money. He says, here, have what's yours back. He hasn't, I haven't done anything, haven't touched it. But the master says, you wicked and you slothful servant. Slothful, and slothful was the word that stood out at me. And I kind of thought, what, you know what? Like, what was this guy doing, actually? he had a shovel, he dug a hole. Like, that's hard work, sure. Not good, not profitable work, but it's hard work. He worked up a sweat once, buried his money in the ground, covered it up again, you know, tamped down the dirt. All right, good morning's work. And, you know, then what? Like, you know, what's he doing with the rest of his life now? He was still on the payroll. He still lived in the master's house. He got his food. He got his drink. He had his bed. He had all his needs taken care of, right? He's still in the master's household. So what's he doing every day? I guess, like, it's actually a pretty good gig if you can get it. Like, it's, you know, it's easy work. He's sitting at the beach relaxing. He's kind of, I think we got a slide there. Yeah, there we go. That's him. You know, he's on the Mediterranean Sea there, or maybe that's the Sea of Galilee, and he's just got his feet up, and he's going. So these other two guys, you know, they're waking up early every morning, they're hustling, they're searching around for deals. It's not easy to find investments, not easy to double your money. They're talking to guys, hey, what construction projects are going on? What's the new import? You know, what can we bring in from Rome, you know, what are they doing? And, you know, and they're hunting around for deals. They're finding inefficiencies in the market. You know, this isn't, they're really paying attention. They're hustling every day, waking up early, going to bed late. And this guy, he's sitting at the beach. And he only had, and this is why I think it's not important to say it's like not a hyperbolic amount of money. Like, he really only had a talent, $1 million. Like, We all would be capable of investing $1 million and at least getting interest return. You know, like you think about maybe building a house or something, like all of us could manage the construction of a home. We don't have to build it, but we could manage hiring out like the different builders and the subcontractors, right? You can at least build a house, sell your house, make a little bit of money. Like you buy a franchise. I don't know, it's not that hard to manage $1 million, but this guy didn't even try. And so that's, what was he doing? He was being slothful. So that, I think, was the warning to me and the thing I want to talk about. So the rest of this is going to kind of come from my perspective about areas that I think God convicted me about slothfulness in, my sitting around, my passivity, in places where I'm not actively engaging in managing the resources he has given me to manage. And that's kind of where I'm going to be going. So the other thing I want to say is, you can talk to my wife afterwards if you want, and you can ask her how well I do all these things. But there's a reason God was convicting me about them. So know that I'm not, hopefully I don't come across as someone who's got it all together. So money, I'll start with money. This one's probably the most broadly applicable, and I don't think I'll spend too much time here. But the basic principle God gives about money is that it's God's. He gives it to us to manage it for him. We're his stewards of the wealth he has given us. And I'm naturally pretty cheap and stingy. So for me, giving has always been a struggle. But I want to read the prophet Malachi. And this is a pretty well-known passage, I think. But about tithing, you know, about giving back to God. And I think it's been really a relevant passage to me over the years. So Malachi 3:10-12, God speaks. He says, "Bring the full tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open the windows of heaven for you and pour down for you a blessing until there is no more need. I will rebuke the devourer for you, so that it will not destroy the fruits of your soil, and your vine in the field shall not fail to bear, says the Lord of hosts. Then all the nations will call you blessed, for you will be a land of delight, says the Lord of hosts." And God repeats this promise in many places. And it's actually, I think, one of the few places where he actually says, test me in this. So give me the first fruits of your labor. You know, in Israel's society, that was 10%. And test me and see if I'm not faithful to bless you back even more. And I think the reason God says to test him in this is because it's really a starting point for the rest of our lives and our faithfulness. So it's just, you know, a challenge, I guess, to can we trust God enough to test him with our giving? And pay attention, right? Like, if he says, test me, it means I'm paying attention. I'm not just kind of blindly giving, but I'm actually actively engaged in the process, paying attention to it, and seeing if God's being faithful to me in it. If you've ever read the book God's Smuggler, it's about a Dutch missionary called Brother Andrew. He became famous by smuggling, well, he became famous in this book, but he started his career smuggling Bibles into communist countries. The book was published kind of after the wall fell, and the need for that specific ministry kind of died away. And then, yeah, he got famous through the book, because it's really an incredible read. I meant to look and see if it's in the library here, but I forgot. He writes about his early years. He went to this Bible school in Scotland, and the school didn't, it charged a very minimal salary, and it didn't pay any teachers or anything. It really worked on a principle of, like, faith in God's provision only, and it was kind of like the George Mueller approach, you know, where you don't ask for anything. So this story, this is an excerpt from the book. It's in his early years, and he's told he's going to go with five other men, and they're going to travel around Scotland preaching and teaching and stuff, and they're going to be given a £1 note for their funds along the way. So that's where we start reading from Brother Andrew's perspective. "I laughed. Sounds like we'll be passing the hat all the time. Oh, you're not allowed to take up collections. Never. You're not to mention it at your meetings. All your needs have got to be provided without any manipulation on your part, or the experiment is a failure. I was a member of a team of five boys. Later, when I tried to reconstruct where our funds came from during those 4 weeks, it was hard to. It seemed that what we needed was always just there. Sometimes a letter would arrive from one of the boys' parents with a little money, Sometimes we would get a check in the mail from a church we had visited days or weeks earlier. The notes that came with these gifts were always interesting. I know you don't need the money or you would have mentioned it, someone would write, but God just wouldn't let me get to sleep tonight until I had put this in an envelope for you. Contributions frequently came in the form of produce. In one little town in the Highlands of Scotland, we were given 600 eggs. We had eggs for breakfast, eggs for lunch. Eggs as hors d'oeuvres before a dinner of eggs, with an egg white meringue for dessert. It was weeks before we could look a chicken in the eye. But money or produce, we stuck fast to two rules. We never mentioned a need aloud, and we gave away a tithe of whatever came to us as soon as we got it, within 24 hours, if possible. Another team that set up from the school at the same time that we did was not so strict about tithing. They set aside their 10% all right, but they didn't give it away immediately in case we run into an emergency. Of course they had emergencies. So did we every day. But they ended their month owing money to hotels, lecture halls, and markets all over Scotland. But we came back to school almost 10 pounds ahead. As fast as we could give money away, God was always swifter, and we ended up with money to send to the work overseas. Just a really kind of a story that I remembered as kind of being impactful to my thought about, you know, just God testing God and seeing his faithfulness. So I'm not going to go any more really into money management because this is like a sermon series that could stretch out very long. But just two thoughts. The first is Proverbs 10:22. The blessings of the Lord make rich, and he adds no sorrow with it. So, our goal, we're not striving after riches, but it does say that if you're faithful and to follow God, in general, most of the time, he gives you true wealth, but he also doesn't add sorrow with it. And you could easily think of like a lot of billionaires in our world, or the mega rich who have terrible families, kids who hate them, only come around for the money, divorces, and really don't envy them, right? But the blessing of the Lord makes rich, and he adds no sorrow with it. And then the other last thing I want to say is from Luke 16:11, and this is the parable of the dishonest steward, I think. That's a complicated parable too, but the conclusion is all I'm going to dig into here or say. And Jesus says, this is his conclusion. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to true riches? So according to Jesus, that's really just has to be step one. It's the foundation. If we can't even be faithful in giving our money, like, we're not going to go anywhere in God's kingdom. So I'm going to talk about, like, true riches, maybe. But the first thing in my mind is, like, my children. That's really the first true riches God has entrusted me to. And a couple areas of conviction in there that God has spoke to me about. The first is just time with them. You know, coming back from work, I could be tired, I could feel lazy, and am I just going to lie around? Worst of all, look at my phone or something? Or do I actually engage with my kids? You know, it's just a constant challenge for me. But we don't need to dive into that too much because, that's something our culture is actually really good at recognizing the value of. And we get that message a lot, right? Be with your kids, be present with your kids. It's, we all know it. There's no surprise there. But the other the thing I'm going to spend a little more time on is, I guess we could even look at Matthew 19:14. I kind of had a laugh when I was reading this. So, you know, that's when Jesus is teaching, and then someone brings their kids to talk to Jesus, and the disciples are like, you know, get out of here. This guy's busy. He's doing important things. Jesus says, let the children, little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for to such belong the kingdom of heaven. So he modeled treating his children with priority to us, of course. But after that, it says that he laid his hands on them, and he went away. So even Jesus needed a break sometimes. But the other area that I was a little more challenged on is our responsibility to discipline our children. So this is an area where our culture leads us astray because our culture does not value that. And our culture almost, you know, has the impression that our kids don't need discipline. Let them lead, you know, watch a Disney movie, right? Their kids are always right. Parents are always wrong. Yeah, it's a little bit of oversimplification, but our culture does not value the need for parents to discipline and raise their children. So that's something we need as parents to go to the Bible in, and especially as fathers, you know. If you can think of something, yell it out right now and let me know. But I don't think the Bible ever tells mothers to discipline their children. It only tells it to fathers, as far as I can remember. Now, that doesn't mean that mothers don't discipline their children. The Bible is obviously patriarchal, so it's assumed that what goes to a man is also going to the family. Like, it was written to a patriarchal society. That was just the way nouns were used. But still, I think, you know, as men, we need that reminder. And it's important for us to have that reminder that ultimately the family responsibility is mine. Ephesians 6:4 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." In Colossians 3:21, "Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." So that's kind of the one, two from the epistles. You know, there's way more than I'm going to quote here. But just bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, and then don't discourage them. Make sure that you're encouraging them, not just laying, like the Pharisees, heavy burdens on them and then not helping them carry them. And again, this is like, this could be a whole sermon series. I'm just touching on it because it was areas God convicted me on. We'll get 1 Timothy 3, 1-5 also. We'll talk, kind of this dovetails a little bit with the next section. But Paul writes to Timothy and he says, "This saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of an overseer," so that's in a church, like leading a church, "he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church?" And that's, you know, Paul saying, right, this is your proving ground as a man. Now, there's a lot of things that could be brought up in regard to church leadership, and they have been, and I'm going to skip them all, because this is what God was convicting me about. So but I have my apologies if you say, "Hey, what about?" I'm saying, "Well, I'm not talking about that, sorry." This is where God is convicting me. And I hope you could recognize that I'm not advocating for a man to be the master of the house, to dictate, you know, to be the king who commands. Grant said a while ago a phrase that really stuck with me, which is, a true leader gives away power. And, you know, obviously, as leaders in a house, we need to, if we don't have that attitude, we're not following Christ. You know, love your wives, give yourself up for her as Christ left the church, right? That's always the command. But am I, this is what God convicted me of, am I being slothful in the raising of my children, in the discipline and the management of the house? Am I just sitting back and saying, Erica's doing a good job, and she is doing a great job, so I can just sit back and say, she's doing a good job, I don't need to be involved. And, you know, God convicted me that that's not right. We kind of was talking to Erica about this a little bit just before the message, and she brought up a really interesting point, which I hadn't thought of, and that's like, she's at home with the kids, I'm off at work, and then usually, like, when I come home, that's when the fun things will happen, right? Like, maybe we'll go to the lake if it's hot, or we play a game, or jump on the trampoline, but the dad's the fun one, and mean old mom is always giving the rules, always saying no. And so, like, and then the other thing is, she might be working on something or seeing behavior problems that I'm not seeing during the day, so she's trying to kind of steer things in a certain direction, and I'm not involved and active. I'm just, like, letting things go, letting them misbehave or letting them have things that she's trying to, you know, work on because she sees the problems. And if I'm just being passive, I'm actually working against her by accident, just by being passive. That's not right. And then the other thing is, so if I can be engaged and I can be like, hey, what are we working on together? What's our priorities? What do I see? What do you see? And I'm not being a dictator, but I'm just being active. I'm not being slothful. I'm not being this guy who's sitting back at the beach, relaxing, right? I think that just adds to my responsibility, I guess, as the manager of the home. It's not to take the power from her, but it's actually to give her more power in a day, in her life. And it actually does help her in practical ways, because if we realize together that this is something we're working on, and then she can, during the day, when the discipline is time to discipline, and she's there and I'm not, she can always say, hey, this is what Dad said we're doing. You got a problem, take it up with him. And then if I can be on it, and I'm aware of what's happening, and then when I'm home, I can be the first to get in there and give her a little break. It makes it that much easier for her to do it when I'm not there. So I can actually empower her to do that role better by just not being slothful, by being active. So that's something that God really kind of was speaking to me about. Now, a small example of this was with our kids a few months ago. They were just getting really whiny. They've just kind of gotten into the habit of whining for everything. And it just kind of, we've just kind of been ignoring it, hoping they'd get over it. And Erica was more worried about it than I was because I didn't see it all day. But actually, it was because I kind of was convicted not to be slothful that I kind of felt like, okay, I need to talk to her about it. And we just talked about it and realized, like, we don't need to do anything different. We just need to be more consistent, faster to discipline, not fuss and whine at them, just quickly say, okay, you're having your time out. And, you know, it wasn't actually very long before they improved, and they just got less whiny, but it was just because we got consistent and quick with the discipline, but it was because we did it as a team that we saw the results, I think. So, it's kind of a dumb example. Probably a lot of you are laughing at us, like, oh, what do you have teenagers? So, I'm not trying to make this sound like super parodic or anything, but it's just illustrative and to me, I guess, about, like, the value of not being passive in that role. And I'm sorry, I'm going a little long here, so I'll try to speed it up. The last point I had was family devotions, spiritual growth, and leading them there. This is an area I know I'm not doing as good as I could be in. My parents actually really modeled to us, like, family devotions, and I remember that being really fun. Like, we would sing songs, we'd do all the fun actions. We used to, like, act out Bible stories sometimes. The kids would, like, act out a story. We'd try to think of, like, the weirdest ones we knew so we could trick our parents into not guessing it. Dad had done some puppet shows when he was in Bible school as, like, a youth ministry thing, so he had a little bit of an ace up his sleeve, but he would sometimes do those puppet shows for us, and we loved them. And, anyways, I'm kind of convicted because my game is not there, it's there. We just read a Bible story and put him to bed. retired. But, so, yeah, kind of convicted to just, like, step that game up a little bit, I guess. Make it fun, make them love it, you know, if you can. That's like, the role of the leader. And, okay, I'm going to try to go a little faster. I'm sorry, I'm taking a long time. The last one is church life and being involved in the church. And I think, like, as this passage says, you know, like, first take care of your household. And I think that's what God's convicted me at, is, like, as young kids especially, you know, be that one sheep. Don't worry about those 99 sheep. Go find your one sheep first. But that being said, there's some really obvious opportunities that I can do. And the first one is just in, like, looking around the church and seeing maybe people who aren't connected or who aren't, you know, don't know anyone, and just being hospitable, you know, looking to do good. Galatians 6, 9 and 10 says, "Let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." So, yeah, that's kind of like the most obvious opportunity, I guess, for me in church life, is just looking around and being like, where are there needs that my family or I can meet? And just trying to be active, you know, just not being thoughtful, not just like, just disengaging and being passive and letting that ability just sit there. And then the other advice I was given by a godly man I know is just be where your kids are. So if your kids are in, like, Sunday school, be in Sunday school. If your kids are in youth group, be in youth group. And that's just a very practical, you know, synergy. Well, it's corporate loves the word synergy, but kind of a way to be with your kids and be in the church setting. So the kind of convictions God has given me on that, I'm going to move on to my summary. And the biggest thing I want you to get from this is that I'm not doing this. I'm failing. But the advantage we have an advantage over this third manager, because I would be him, probably. But we have one advantage, and that is that we have a master who hasn't actually left us. And he's here with us. Jesus says in John 15, verse 4 to 5, "Abide in me, and I in you. As a branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." In the previous verse, Jesus had said, you know, as a branch cannot bear fruit by itself, neither can you unless you abide in me. But really where our focus always needs to be is, are we rooted in growing in Jesus? Are we having that daily relationship with him and getting our strength from him rather than trying to do it on our own effort? So, I have a quote from Watchman Nee. If you know him, he's a Chinese evangelist. He wrote a book called The Normal Christian Life, and it's all dedicated to experiencing the life of Christ as the normal life for a Christian, having his power work in us. And it's a whole book, and he'd be the first to say, this isn't something you learn from a book. You know, you learn it by experiencing life with Jesus, but this is our direction. Anyway, he had a quote here about grafting and getting life, and it's just illustrative of the type of fruits I want in my life. So he writes, "In Fujian, I once visited a man who owned an orchard of longan trees. He had 3 or 4 acres of land and about 300 fruit trees. I inquired if his trees had been grafted or if they were of the original stock. "Do you think," he replied, "that I would waste my land growing ungrafted trees? What value could I ever expect from the old stock?" So I asked him to explain the process of grafting, which he gladly did. "When a tree has grown to a certain height," he said, "I lop off the top and graft onto it." Pointing to a special tree, he asked, "Do you see that tree? I call it the father tree, because all the grafts for the other trees are taken from that one. If the other trees were just left to follow the course of nature, their fruit would be only about the size of a raspberry and would consist mainly of thick skins and seeds. This tree, from which the grafts for all the others are taken, bears a luscious fruit the size of a plum, with a very thick skin and a tiny seed. And, of course, all the grafted trees bear fruit like it. How does this happen?" I asked. "I simply take a little of the nature of one tree and transfer it to the other," he explained. "I make a cleavage in the poor tree and insert a slip from the good one. Then I bind it up and leave it to grow." "But how can it grow?" I asked. "I don't know," he said, "but it does grow." Then he showed me a tree bearing miserably poor fruit from the old stock below the graft, and the rich, juicy fruit from the new stock above the graft. "I have left the old shoots with their useless fruit on them to show the difference," he said. "From it you can understand the value of grafting. You can appreciate, can you not, why I grow only grafted trees. So how can one tree bear the fruit of another? How can a poor tree bear good fruit? Only by grafting. Only by implanting into it the life of a good tree. But if a man can graft a branch of one tree into another, cannot God take the life of his son and, so to speak, graft it into us?" And so, yeah, that's, you know, that picture of, like, these reedy little fruits here left on their own and the juicy, abundant fruit from the graft, you know, and the grafted branch. That's, like, the picture we want in our lives, right? It's not of us trying harder and doing, but it's about us receiving the life of Christ to change our behavior, to change our habits, and to, you know, produce fruit that gives glory to him because he did the work. And he's really quite generous because he gives us these talents and these things to manage. And then he gives us the power and the strength to do it. And then he says, after it's all done, he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." And, you know, there is, I think we can all testify to that. There's a real joy in doing what God has given us to do. Even if it's tiring, there's a satisfaction and a joy there. So that's, you know, I guess that's the goal, right? And you have to know where you're going in order to get there. where we're going is kind of not... Where I'm going, I guess, where my conviction is to not just be passive, to sit back, to let the world wash over me, to bury what God's given me in the ground, to actively be involved in it, but then also actively knowing that it's not something I can do on my own, something I need Christ to do through me. You know, there's a warning there too, right? To the unfaithful servant, he says, "Cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." So it's kind of like a blessing and a warning and a promise. That's kind of the message, or the kind of where God was putting thoughts in my heart. As a final prayer, it's just kind of like, God, please give me this power I need to be your servant and give me that life, you know, of the vine, abiding, help me to abide in you. Let me use the talents you've given me to be invested in your kingdom. All right, that's my talk. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate it.
Steve, you're such a good friend for sharing what God is laying on your heart with the rest of us. That's what we need from each other.